From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, sitting in for Michael Krasny this morning. In November 2004, California voters passed Proposition 71, investing state money in stem cell research. The measure created the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine, and over the past 5 years, that agency has handed out over $1 billion in research funding. But what has that funding accomplished? Are we getting closer to finding cures for diseases like Alzheimer's and diabetes that stem cell proponents and patients had hoped for? This week, an international stem cell research gathering gets underway in San Francisco, and we wanted to take a look at the state of the science and the current direction of stem cell research. That's coming up on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, in this morning for Michael Krasny. In 1998, a University of Wisconsin scientist named Jamie Thompson discovered how to create embryonic stem cells, cells that had the potential to become any cell type in the human body. Almost immediately, the possibility that those cells could be used to fix what goes wrong in any number of diseases created enormous excitement. But there was also a catch. Embryonic stem cells are derived from frozen human embryos left over from in vitro fertilization clinics. And the ensuing controversy, including a decision by President Bush that allowed only limited federal funding, impacted the pace of research. So in 2004, California voters decided to get into the stem cell research business and pass Proposition 71. That measure created a state institute for regenerative medicine. And in the almost 6 years since then, the institute has funded 29 new labs and $1 billion worth of research. So are we now any closer to finding a cure for all those diseases stem cells were supposed to fix? Or were the benefits perhaps overly hyped by proponents and the press alike? The International Society for Stem Cell Research is holding its 8th annual convention in San Francisco this week, so we thought a good time to look at the state of stem cell science and get some answers to those particular questions. Joining us to do that, Dr. Arnold Kriegstein. He's the director of the Eli and Edith Broad Center of Regeneration Medicine and Stem Cell Research at the University of California, San Francisco. Good morning.
And good morning, Dave.
Joining us as well, David Roach. He's professor of pediatrics and neurological surgery and chief of neonatology at UCSF. He's also a Howard Hughes Medical Institute investigator. He'll be leading a stem cell clinical trial soon. Dr. Roach, good morning.
Good morning, David.
And joining us, too, is Dr. Marius Wernig. He's assistant professor at the Institute for Stem Cell Biology and Regenerative Medicine at Stanford University. Dr. Wernig, good morning.
Good morning.
Happy to have all of you here. Let's begin, Dr. Kriegstein, with the question of hype, because I think in those early days there was so much excitement about the possibilities and that we would finally be able to come to a way of fixing some of these terrible diseases. Did we oversell the promise?
Well, I think I agree, of course, that there's enormous excitement about the prospect of stem cells for treating currently really untreatable diseases. And we certainly, all of us, I think, believe that very, very sincerely. The problem really is the pace of the research. As you may know, biological research especially proceeds very slowly, often taking unexpected twists and turns. And it's very, very difficult to make predictions even a few years in advance, let alone decades in advance. And so I think most of us are cautious and cautiously optimistic about the prospect of near-term benefits. But in the long run, I think there will be enormous benefits from the work that's going on now.
Are we any closer to fixing any of these conditions? Early on, it was thought this might lead away to perhaps finding a cure for something like diabetes, for a variety of neurological conditions, including perhaps Alzheimer's and others. Are we closer to that day?
Yes. Yes, I think we're definitely closer to that day. But it's, again, difficult to predict exactly when that day will be. We've made enormous progress, for instance, in diabetes and in figuring out how to take an unspecialized cell and turning it into an islet cell, which is the kind of replacement cell you need to make insulin for patients who have diabetes. Now, whether those cells will be safe and how they'll be delivered and many other technical issues are still major challenges. Nonetheless, we've really come a long way in figuring out the developmental program for how to make these cells. And that's a very important basic step toward that goal.
You willing to give us some sort of timeline on when that day might be?
No, I really can't make the prediction, but I can say that the CIRM, as you mentioned, has been really funding.
That's the center for the California Institute for Regenerative
Medicine. Yes, the California Institute, that's part of Prop 71. And they've actually been funding what they call disease team grants, which are large multimillion-dollar grants involving multiple investigators and private companies as well to really bring therapies to the patients, to actually start clinical trials. And there's one at UCSF that's been funded that way, involving a partnership with Novacell, a company in San Diego, to actually move toward a clinical trial in diabetes within 4 or 5 years.
So it does sound like if the magic bullet won't be found in X number of years, we're going to know a lot more. This isn't just going to be research in the lab. This
Absolutely.
Will have clinical output, clinical trials relatively soon.
Yes, exactly. And in fact, as you know, we've already started a clinical trial at UCSF in a very rare neurological disease.
And that brings us to Dr. David Roach, who is involved in that particular study. Before we get, though, to your research, let's spend a moment on what these cells are, because one of the things that's changed over the last 12 years is how we find them. I described how embryonic stem cells are derived from human embryos left over from in vitro fertilization clinics. But there are lots of ways now that we can get at these stem cells that make a difference. Tell us something about both the kind that you're using, Dr. Roach, but the other interesting kinds of ways in which these cells can be derived.
Sure. So I think Arnold had mentioned the benefit that we have as researchers coming from a background in developmental biology, and by understanding how an organ develops, we get clues about the nature of stem cells and also how we might be able to recover them and also how we might be able to instruct them such that they could form useful cell types that might be helpful in certain diseases. So separate from embryonic stem cells are cells that can be derived from adult tissues. And these could come, you could imagine, from donated organs or even from a patch of skin that could be donated by a subject for production of stem cells. Now, these stem cells are distinct from embryonic stem cells in that they can't make every type of cell of the body. They're specialized for making particular cells of an organ. So, for example...
And that's because they're a little bit later in the game, right?
Exactly. So they've already made decisions to commit to forming the heart or the brain, and that then restricts their further potential. Now, in particular, I'm interested in the neural stem cells. These are cells that persist even in the adult brain. They're cells that can be taken out of the brain, cultured in the laboratory, expanded, and then further instructed to form some of the cardinal cell types of the brain, which we call neurons, oligodendrocytes, and astrocytes. And each of these cells has particular functions in terms of maintenance of neurological function.
And your particular interest is in trying to do something about a deadly disease that affects infants early on in life.
Right. So the particular disease that we're focused on at UCSF has a difficult-to-pronounce name, Pelizaeus-Merzbacher disease. So I'll use PMD as an easier way to say that. This is a very tragic condition that affects males because it's passed on in the X chromosome, and so preferentially male children will be affected. Such children have a very devastating neurological course. They will often have difficulty breathing at birth. They often will have subtle movement disorders in their eyes, and then later on they'll fail to crawl, walk, or really be able to vocalize. The lifespan for these kids is about 5 to 7 years, and this is a universally fatal disorder in its most severe form, which we call the conatal form.
And what do you hope to be able to do now that this clinical trial, which is, correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the first times that there has been a clinical trial of this sort, is that correct?
This will be the first type of clinical trial that's aimed at determining the safety of neural stem cells for a condition in which there's a lack of oligodendrocytes, and these are myelin-producing cells. So I should probably say a little word about this cardinal cell type, the oligodendrocyte, one of the three types of cells in the brain. It has one primary function, and that's to make a substance called myelin, which coats nerve fibers, and that allows nerves to fire properly. People might have heard of oligodendrocytes because in the disease multiple sclerosis, oligodendrocytes undergo an autoimmune attack, and sort of chunks of myelin are destroyed in that disease, resulting in profound neurological dysfunction in MS patients. In PMD, you might imagine it as the worst case of MS imaginable, because this is a disease in which the oligodendrocytes fail to have the ingredients to make myelin. And so in the brain of these children, there's a complete lack of myelin throughout.
And so when you now insert these cells that will hopefully give those infants something that they do not have, are you optimistic about it making a difference in the lives of those children? Or at this point, is this really only being done to see whether or not more can be done?
I think it's too early to say whether this is a therapy that is likely to help children. We do have a strong scientific grounding for the possibility of cells like these being able to contribute. In other words, once they have been put into a host environment, in this case I'm talking about animal studies, that lack myelin, the cells do seem to be able to understand the need to produce myelin, and they will differentiate appropriately and produce the myelin substance, which in animals has been shown to improve their neurological function and in some cases survival. So there's that grounding in science that gives us at least the prospect of potential benefit of these approaches. But there are fundamental questions that we have to answer about the safety before I think we can really even look forward to the clinical trials to help function.
And normally, of course, you would want those safety considerations completely answered before you would engage in human trials, I assume. But in this case, it sounds like the disease is so lethal that there's a willingness among those parents to go forward with this, even knowing that it may or may not help them, just because it will advance the state of science. Is that right?
I think your characterization is accurate, and I want to also generalize that, because there are many circumstances where there are diseases that are in a terminal phase. We may have friends that have undergone cancer chemotherapeutic trials because they have end-stage cancer. And in situations where there are terminal illnesses, the balance shifts, where the risk-benefit ratio in the patient's mind may shift towards looking at novel types of therapies. And I think also there's the idea that some patients feel like this could help others, and they're motivated by those factors as well.
Dr. David Roach joining us this hour. He's professor of pediatrics and neurological surgery at the University of California, San Francisco. Marius Wernick joins us too. He's assistant professor at the Institute for Stem Cell Biology and Regenerative Medicine at Stanford University. It's an interesting point, Dr. Wernick, that I'd like to hear from you about as well, because research has sort of proceeded inch by inch in this arena over the last decade or so. And there's a great interest, obviously, among patient communities for more progress to be made. I hear Dr. Roach saying that one thing that maybe we should think about more is proceeding more aggressively, perhaps with clinical trials, among populations where, frankly, there isn't a lot else that can be done. What's your thought on that?
Of course, that I agree very much with that concept. And that has been sort of in place with the FDA, with the Federal Drug Administration, I guess, since its existence. So there's always more. If there is a potential benefit and there's it's clearly a fatal disease, then there people have always been, of course, inclined to take more risks and because people are hopeful that something can happen.
But not a lot of that has been done to date in some of these neurological conditions. Are there? Correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, it's not like in an advanced case of Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or something else that people are getting stem cell brain transplants.
I agree. So the reason for that is that the brain – so we're talking mostly about neurological diseases now. The brain is an enormously complex organ. And in contrast to other tissues, it does not regenerate all the time. For example, when you take your skin, when you meet somebody and a week later you look him into his face, the skin is completely changed. You don't see the same face again because the turnover is so quick. So those stem cells, they are much more active. And that's why for other tissues, maybe stem cell therapies, and Dr. Kriegstein just mentioned diabetes, where we probably all agree that this is maybe a disease where we will see some improvements much earlier than with neurological diseases, just because of the fact that the organs are simpler and more accessible, and also the stem cells that we dealing with are more favorable for transplantation and for cures.
Dr. Kriegstein, what about pushing more aggressively. The new head of the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine, Alan Trounson, has said, quote, if we went 10 years and had no clinical treatments, it would be a failure. It seems like there's a desire to push ahead more aggressively to get that, you know, divide that's often talked about from the laboratory bench to bedside more quickly. Can tell us something about how that can be done, and is it going to be in, as Dr. Roach and Dr. Vernick have described, perhaps advancing more aggressively certain treatments in people who are ready for that because they know there isn't a lot else that might be helpful?
Well, yes, I can say that as a physician, as a neurologist, I'm well aware of how frustrating it is for patients who have terminal illnesses that are untreatable, not to have the at least the hope or the prospect of a new therapy that might be able to benefit them. On the other hand, as a scientist, I can say that it takes a long time. It was about 25 years or so between the idea that monoclonal antibodies might be useful as a therapy for a drug before actually patients were treated that way. And you know, this is very early days still for stem cell biology. We have a lot to learn about the basic biology of stem cells. And so I certainly applaud the effort to move quickly to the clinic. I think that in the long-term horizon, there'll be some very major significant advances clinically. But the early tests, for example, the tests that we're doing, the trial that's going on at UCSF now, those are primarily safety trials. And they'll teach us an enormous amount about how these cells behave in the human body.
And will those have applicability then to other kinds of disease treatments? Will we learn from Dr. Roach's study, for example, if we learn they're safe, for example, does then that have applicability to how stem cell transplants for other conditions might be safe or not?
Well, that's a little difficult to say because each of these cell derivatives, these stem cell derivatives that are made from an undifferentiated cell type and that are specialized and then delivered to a patient, they're all different. The protocols for actually making these cells are different, and the risks associated with them may also differ. So I'm not sure that we can directly take the results of this trial and transfer them to another trial. On the other hand, we're learning an enormous amount by doing trials like this. We're learning how the cells behave in a human body instead of, say, a rodent or even a monkey. There are enormous differences in that regard, and we just don't understand them well enough.
In some ways, Dr. Roach, this points to one of the frustrations, but probably also a kind of central truth in all of this, which is that each disease is different, each stem cell is different, each stem cell can only do one thing, or you want to train it to do one thing. So while we might want to, I quickly want to generalize if yours are safe to saying it's safe, you can't really do that, right?
Right. I think what's more likely is if we found some sort of a problem with tolerance of the cells once we've put them into patients, the negative implications could have general effects. So I think another important function of these sort of safety studies, we're looking for the possibility of the cells making a patient's condition worse. I think any sign that there was a negative side effect of these cells would have a general impact and would make us take a very close look at further studies because of the potential for doing harm with patients.
Well, and that's one of the – there was – as I understand it, a study that was going to go forward at, I believe, the University of California, Irvine, clinical trial involving spinal cord damage that was supposed to go into action last year. And almost at the last moment, there was data that said, well, maybe not. Dr. Vernon?
Yes. So that was actually a spinal cord injury trial. And that, in fact, was a trial using embryonic stem cells that were described before, and they have even more. They're even more complicated and more difficult to deal with than the adult stem cells that Dr. Roach described, and that's why people are very, very careful. And to my knowledge, the trial was put on hold because they had some evidence in an animal model that there might be a small potential of tumor formation in these cells. So that's why they said, okay, we don't want to go into patients right now. We really want to check carefully what these tumor structures are like and whether we can improve that.
Are spinal cord injuries one of the prospects that's closer to clinical trials than other kinds of neurological problems?
It's really hard to say because we all know that rodents are very different from humans, and we can in fact get very nice results in rodent animals, but yeah. when you then
a lot of mice have been fixed at
right.
a lot of levels.
That
yeah.
is right. Yeah. And one clear difference is just a mere size. So if you want to introduce cells into about maybe half an inch size brain bears compared to and maybe what is it, 5 or 6 inch long brain, that is a huge difference, or just the delivery of the cells.
Dr. Crickstein, on the spinal cord question, is that something that if you had to sort of rank the prospects, and I know this is the kind of question scientists hate, but I'm going to ask it anyway, does that bump up toward the top of the list, spinal cord injuries, as having higher prospects for being into the clinic sooner?
Well, it's a terrible disorder for which, as you know, there's almost no treatment. And so I think it does merit that kind of consideration. On the other hand, fatal diseases like ALS, for instance, Lou Gehrig's disease, are probably a bit higher on the list. And one might be able to, when you look at the risk-benefit ratio that we've been talking about, it may be that one could take a greater risk in a disease like that than one would, say, with spinal cord injury.
Because someone can still live a relatively active, certainly productive life with a spinal cord injury, whereas with ALS, the clock's really ticking.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. So tell us, Dr. Virnik, something about the kind of cells you're working with, because we've talked a little bit about embryonic stem cells. We've talked some about the adult stem cells that Dr. Roach was describing. You work with something called induced pluripotent stem cells. Mm-hmm. This is the discovery that was made about 2 years ago, where you could take a skin cell and essentially reprogram it, get it back to its essentially embryonic state. And you've skipped all of the ethical questions surrounding everything with embryonic stem cells. What are the advantages of those kinds of cells that you're working with? What are their prospects to advance something to the clinic more promptly?
Sure. So first of all, maybe I can go a step back and just categorize the – we've talked about stem cells, but there's really many, many different kinds of stem cells. So there is, first of all, the many different adult stem cells, and those are the stem cells in our body which are responsible for maintaining tissues. So there is blood stem cells making blood, there is skin stem cells making skin, and so on and so forth. And then there's this other kind that we also talked about, the embryonic stem cells. And they come from the very, very early embryo, from the discarded in vitro fertilized embryos. And in contrast to the adult stem cells, these embryonic stem cells, they can differentiate into all kind of tissues. So whereas the skin stem cells can only make skin, and the blood stem cells can only make blood, the embryonic stem cells, they can make all the tissues in our body. So that's why people were so excited about 10 years ago when Jamie Thompson discovered those cells in human. But there was a problem, because these embryonic stem cells are derived from these IVF embryos, and they would not match the patient. So when you transplant them, they would be subject to immune rejection. So, and as you mentioned a couple of years ago, it was really Shinya Yamanaka, a Japanese scientist, who first discovered in the mouse back then that he can introduce four factors into skin cells, which turns them into stem cells which look very, very similar to these embryonic stem cells.
We have to pause and take a break. But as I'm hearing it, one of the primary advantages of those is that they are matched directly with the patient. So
exactly.
You don't have to worry about some sort of response, the body rejecting
exactly.
those particular
you
cells.
You can treat the patients with their own stem cells if you want.
We'll come back and talk about that more and what the prospects are for stem cell science in general when we return. We'd like to hear your questions and comments, too, about this subject. You can join us now at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org, or just go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and add your comment there. Back in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, the state of stem cell science. It's been almost 6 years since the state of California passed Proposition 71, which got the state into the stem cell research business. There have been hundreds of grants that have gone forward, labs that have been built, research that's been funded. What have we learned so far? How far in time will it be before we have enough information to help get after some of these diseases for which we hope stem cells will provide part of the answer. That's the topic we're exploring. We're joined by Dr. Arnold Kriegstein, who is the head of the Center of Regeneration Medicine and Stem Cell Research at the University of California, San Francisco. David Roach, who's professor of pediatrics and neurological surgery and the chief of neonatology at UCSF. And Marius Wernick, assistant professor in the Institute for Stem Cell Biology and Regenerative Medicine at Stanford University. We welcome your calls and concerns, questions on this topic as well, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can email us at forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and add your comment there. Dr. Roach, there is always, as you were saying during the break, this sort of inherent tension between the understandable cautionary instincts of scientists and of institutions and the eagerness for patients to be helped with conditions for which there is currently a cure. I should acknowledge, as some in our audience know, that I come at this question not exactly as a completely disinterested observer. I was diagnosed with Parkinson's a few years ago. My father had Parkinson's. A brother has it as well. So I know something about the eagerness for which people push. How do you respond to that sort of understandable push, but also the understandable need to proceed with all appropriate caution?
David, I think that's a very interesting question to deal with. I'm a physician, and so I take care of patients that have fatal disorders. And so I'm also looking for new approaches, especially when there are diseases for which we know that medical therapy really offers no benefit at this point. So I'm in the camp, I guess, of some families of really looking for novel and new therapies to apply. I think the benefit of having a scientific background also lets me look at diseases in rational terms and understand where I think you could make a practical difference and where a particular approach could make progress in terms of generating a general benefit of, in my case, neural stem cell therapies.
There's also this question, Dr. Kriegstein, that as we learn more about diseases, unfortunately, in some ways, we learn how complicated they are. And let me just pursue Parkinson's for a moment. I do not want to dwell on that. But one of the things about Parkinson's that people have learned is it used to be the thought that, well, Parkinson's brains don't make a substance called dopamine. You fix that, you fix the disease. You put in a dopamine-producing stem cell, that'll maybe take care of it. Now we're learning, of course, that it's more complicated than that, that there's also problems with sense of smell or your GI system. There's a lot of things going on, and that won't simply fix it. Comment on that part of it, because some people now think that with some of these neurological conditions, maybe stem cells aren't the ticket, that there may be other factors in play that we have to pay just as much attention to.
Yes, no, I'm very happy you brought that up. I think that's exactly right. The promise of regenerative therapy really was replacing tissues or cells with replacement cells generated from these embryonic or other kinds of stem cells. But the truth is, as you say, many of these diseases are really just too complicated, and that's a kind of naive or simplistic approach that just a single cell type might cure a disease. In most cases, it's probably short of the mark. It may help. It may help with some of the symptoms, but it may not really cure the disease. But what I want to flip that sort of upside down. What we were starting to talk about just before the break was a new opportunity for actually making stem cells from patients who have specific diseases. And this is an application of stem cell biology, I think, that is going to have enormous impact in the near future. And that's the ability to actually model some of these complicated diseases with human cells in a laboratory, where in the past we've only had animal models of the disease, which really fall far short of giving a true representation of what the disease is like.
Well, that's something that you're focused on in particular, Dr. Wernick. And as I understand it, what Dr. Kriegstein is talking about is you can essentially create the disease in a dish, right? And so that gives you the opportunity to really see what's going on in a way that science has not been able to in the past.
Exactly. That is the hope. So we are not really there yet to have demonstrated that this is possible. But we all believe that many of our diseases are caused by our genes, the genetic makeup that every individual has.
So tell me how this would work. You would take a skin cell from someone
right.
with a particular neurodegenerative disorder, let's say.
Right.
You turn that back into its earliest state. But because it has that person's genetic makeup,
exactly.
you'd have the very beginnings then of that condition right in your petri dish?
No, what you do is you take your skin cells, you introduce these factors, these reprogramming factors, as we call them, and you mix these induced pluripotent stem cells, which I just explained before. They are very similar to the embryonic stem cells. And you can take those stem cells and differentiate them into, let's say, neurons, let's say dopamine neurons, which are lacking in Parkinson's disease. And those cells, then you can study. And that is a major...
And study what's gone wrong?
Study what is going wrong, right. So there's this really these two flavors that these pluripotent stem cells have. You can either use them in theory, to graft into patients or to just keep them in the dish, just keep them in culture and see what is going wrong in these cells. And that is a great advancement because we are really limited with our disease models, as we said earlier, usually with rodents, with mice or rats. And there is, especially when it comes to brain and higher brain functions, they are very different from us.
So in this sense... Would it be fair to say that part of what stem cell science may bring us is a keener understanding of what's going wrong in that individual cell, which might lead to a solution that doesn't have anything to do with stem cells? I mean, right? I mean, you might learn what's gone wrong and then figure out how to fix that that wouldn't necessarily involve doing a stem cell transplant.
Absolutely. But you could also think of using these stem cells in culture to screen for drugs or other molecules.
I see, to see what works.
What could, right.
Yeah.
So you have a model in the dish. You don't have to go to a clinical trial. You can make a mini trial, so to say, mini clinical trial in the lab and then figure out what drug could potentially
So sort
work.
Of a clinical trial, but in a petri dish.
In a petri dish, so to say. And you don't have to go through the animal. You work with human cells, with human neurons right away, which has not been possible until now.
Alan Trenson joins us now. He's president of the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine. Dr. Trenson, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Dave.
We were mentioning earlier that you've been pushing the idea that we need to get to clinical trials faster, that people want to see research advance. Walk us through then what your priorities are, because it sounds like they could go in several different directions, that you want to push those things that could get to the clinic fastest, but still at the same time push ahead on the sort of basic biological research front.
Yes, I mean, it's twofold. I think, in the sense of the money that was raised here in California, I think the community would really, really appreciate it if some of the treatments evolved into the clinic so that some of the conditions that they face where there's very little treatment option, they could actually have it as a result of this research. So that would be very meaningful to them. But to get to there, we have to continue the basic research because there's so many questions on the way, if you like. It's just such a new science that we face new questions almost every day. So without the basic science engine still purring, if you like, making the work happen, then I think the ability to get into the clinic is dramatically reduced. So our intention is to push very hard for the clinical applications, but to ensure that the basic science keeps up with the answers that we need.
So have your evaluation criteria for how you approve grants, because you get lots more applications than you can fund, are you changing the bar to an extent now to what it might have been a few years ago to say, look, this is either going to be studies that will significantly advance basic research, or it's got to be something that can get into the clinic faster?
Yes, I think what we're trying to do is motivate the scientists to do work which really will result in adding to the clinical pathway. That is to help us to take the work to the clinic. So we're not really just saying, well, just submit any kind of research to us. We would very much like and prioritize work that's going to be meaningful for getting applications in the clinic.
Dr. Trenson, can you stay with us just for a moment longer?
Sure.
And take a question or two? Here's one that just came in actually from our website. That it would be great if you could respond to. David writes in, while California is mired in a deep financial crisis that affects everybody from school children to the disabled, the California Stem Cell Agency continues to give away billions of dollars in state funds to institutions linked direct to the directors of the agency. So again, a question about transparency on that part. But I think it's a broader question too, Dr. Trounson, about, you know, the priorities of the state at a time when we're in this large financial crisis.
No, I mean, I absolutely understand the question. I think the issue for actually getting these treatments to happen is that you've actually got to invest for a length of time that's meaningful. So you actually can't turn it off and then turn it back on, because the scientists won't be there. They'll go off into some other area. So the commitment that was made by California was to make this a $3 billion effort to actually create meaningful treatments for patients in the clinic. And the only way to do that is to keep up the funding. And so without that, we would have the staccato stop-start that won't take us really anywhere along that pathway. In fact, it would probably put us off considerably. So this is a really important issue. In science, you have to go for the longer term if you're going to reap the benefits of the basic research.
And on the question that David wants to raise about transparency and possible conflicts of interest, David writes that the dean of the University of California, San Francisco Medical School sits on the governing board of the agency. Obviously, a lot of UCSF scientists, including I think you, Dr. Krikshan, have received money from the California Institute. You can both respond to this, but I think there have been a lot of questions raised about sort of transparency and accountability of the California Institute. Respond to that, Dr. Trounson.
Well, we have a very severe conflicts of interest policy, so that anyone associated with a university or a company or an institution, medical center in California cannot take part in voting for any grant to be accepted. So, and when we go down to the peer review, clearly we're working with out-of-Californian reviewers, and we ensure that they have absolutely no conflicts of interest as well. So as pure as we can get, and as pure as any agency is, we can assure everybody that those conflicts are not actually playing any part in any decision making on behalf of any university.
Dr. Krikshan, respond if you would to that general concern, though, about not, I guess, the transparency question, but I guess I'm also interested in this question of priorities as a state. We all know the mess that California is in. When you see how long science takes, understandable as that may be, it's hard sometimes to say, okay, this really is deserving of a couple of billion dollars, given that we can't seem to fund enough for our elementary schools.
Right. Well, obviously, as a physician scientist, I think that there's very little that is more important for us to do as a society than to deal with some of these really crippling and devastating diseases. So I'm certainly in favor of research in this vein. But in terms of the California proposition, I would have to say that Silicon Valley is world famous now as an engine for technology development, and it's made an impact that's really transformed the world. I think that it may not be too much of an exaggeration to say that stem cell biology and biotechnology in general is the 21st century's Silicon Valley. And if that activity is captured in the state of California, I think that'll be a good thing for the citizens.
In fact, I read an article by a researcher from out of state who envied the fact that California had established that sort of environment and that it was indeed a sort of seductive place for researchers to come. That's part of what you're suggesting as well, I assume.
Well, I go further. David Roach here and Marius Wernig, I think both of them have been recruited. I know I recruited David 4 years ago here. This is largely, I think, a tribute to the CIRM, to the California Stem Cell Institute, that has actually created an environment that attracts, you know, first-class scientists like this.
Let's take some calls from our listener. Keith in San Francisco has a question. Keith, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Keith Davidson. I used to be a science writer for the San Francisco Examiner and San Francisco Chronicle, and if I remember correctly, about 7-8 years ago, one reason the news media got so excited about stem cells is because there were reports that a scientist somewhere, I forget his name, had injected stem cells in a paralyzed mouse. It was able to walk again, and supposedly he had a videotape of this. I don't know what happened to this claim, but my impression is that it just disappeared into the ether. I'd like to know, whatever happened to that, was it completely bogus?
Anyone respond? Dr. Kriegstein?
Yes, I think what you're referring to actually was from Hans Kierstad's lab. And in fact, it was that kind of experimental evidence in animals that led to the trial that was we just discussed a little while ago that was just recently, well, first approved and then put on hold by the FDA. So there's no question that this kind of research is definitely moving forward quickly. But, of course, safety is a major issue when it comes to a disease like spinal cord injury that isn't itself a fatal illness. And so I think we'll have to be a little more patient before a clinical trial begins. But research in spinal cord injury and the application of stem cell biology as some way of dealing with that is certainly going on very aggressively in laboratories all around the state as well as all over the world. So it's still an attractive candidate for some form of stem cell approach.
Ginny writes in, have there been any American agencies that have looked at or acknowledged Americans who have been getting stem cell treatments for years overseas? This gets at the whole question of somewhat shaky or shady stem cell treatments that are touted in various places, some here in the United States, but also in China and a number of other countries. There was a 60-minute investigative piece about this not that long ago. One of you comment on sort of the patient beware advice, I guess, you'd have when you see stem cell treatments that are saying, we can fix whatever you have with our particular stem cell treatment. Dr. Roach?
I think a general concern I have as a physician is wanting to know how I can recommend good options for patients that have been proven to have efficacy. One of the concerns I have about studies done in uncontrolled ways is that we never really see the benefits of the results. We don't know how well it worked. We don't know the problems that were encountered. Often there are a few anecdotal studies that may or may not be ascribed to the effect of the cells, which leads me to wonder if there really is any benefit at all. So that leads me to be concerned also that there are some patients that could be desperate enough that they're being taken advantage of by false claims of efficacy.
It's one of the claims that you should really be aware of, Dr. Kriegstein, when you see something that says, we have a stem cell treatment that can fix heart disease, Alzheimer's, and diabetes, because by definition, that's not possible, right? I mean, you need a different therapy for each of those conditions.
That's exactly right. I think I'm always cautioning patients against the opportunism that exists out there. The snake oil actually now of the 21st century is stem cell biology, the notion that these magical cells can cure anything, as you say. And that's clearly not true. And so listeners here have got to be very cautious when they hear claims like that, or certainly when they're desperate and they look for treatments outside of this country. That's a very risky thing to do.
Let's go next to Melanie in Boulder Creek. Melanie, go ahead.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. You mentioned ALS a little while ago, and I'm curious where the progression is with the clinical trial that's going on with that.
Melanie, you're breaking up, so we'll have to let you go. But we've got the gist of your question, which is, Dr. Kriegstein, I believe you mentioned earlier that ALS, sometimes known as Lou Gehrig's disease, which is invariably fatal, was a candidate to get into the clinic sooner precisely because the consequences are so dire. I think Melanie would like to know where that's at.
Well, there's some very interesting twists and turns to the story of stem cell biology and ALS. Initially, it was considered an attractive disease for actually replacing the motor neurons, the nerve cells that are dying in that illness. And I think that was one of the reasons why ALS was touted as a potential target for stem cell therapy, and it may well still be. But there's a more interesting twist, which is that in the development of stem cells that are the specific kind of motor neurons that die in that disease, those cells were used to find out, in fact, that the cells are in part dying because of a factor of some sort, a toxic factor that's produced by maybe the glial cells, the other kinds of nerve cells that are found there, and poisoning or killing the motor neurons. That concept has now led to the idea that you can possibly rescue the cells, not replace the ones that are dying, but prevent them from dying by using a graft of healthy cells that can somehow counteract the effect of this diffusible factor that's killing them. It's a different concept. Instead of replacing the lost cells, we're trying to rescue them from dying using cells as a kind of a delivery vehicle.
Is one of the other problems here that if there is something that's amiss in the brain that's causing certain brain cells to die, if you just replace those cells, whatever is causing the brain cells to die might still be in play, and so therefore a simple transplant fix isn't going to work, Dr. Roach?
Yeah, I think that's a very important consideration. If we get back to the example I raised earlier of multiple sclerosis, where there's an autoimmune attack on the oligodendrocytes, the myelin-producing cells, the concern about using a stem cell replacement therapy for multiple sclerosis is that the transplanted cells might undergo the same autoimmune attack as the endogenous stem cell precursors.
Couple of email questions coming in. This one asks about the question of funding. On the question of funding research only if it has clear clinical applications, many important medical treatments have had their start with very basic research. For example, some of our understanding of the nervous system comes from the study of roundworms, and understanding genetics and control of development comes from studies with flies. So it's short-sighted not to fund such research. Dr. Johnson, I know you have to leave us, but a quick thought on that question?
Yeah, I mean, of course, that's very important. I suppose the problem is that you have a limited amount of funds, even if you've got, you know, what appears to be a substantial amount. The work on the clinical applications is very much more expensive than the basic science, but you have to actually, you know, focus on your best chances of taking the work forward. So, in some cases, that would be funding some of the very innovative and creative work that would be on C. elegans or roundworms or an animal that can grow a new leg, an axolotl or something. That could well be very important, and we try to pick up those innovative projects in other animals. But if you have to actually fund the whole area, you know, you really leaves you very little funding to sort of push on towards the clinic, where there is now candidates and well-rounded candidates for looking to see whether they can really travel to the clinic. So it's a matter of getting the balance right, or as right as you can, with the quantum of money that you're dealing with.
Dr. Alan Trounson, the director of the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine. Dr. Trounson, thanks for joining in for this part of our conversation.
Thanks very much, Dave.
Yeah, appreciate it. Here's a question from Claire. I've had multiple sclerosis for over 20 years. Are there any plans for stem cell testing in the near future? This is important since I'm allergic to all but one of the drug therapies currently available. You were telling us something, Dr. Roach, about some of the problems with MS in particular in terms of a transplant that would fix the myelin problem. But what can you tell Claire?
Well, Claire, I know the patients with multiple sclerosis, face terrific challenges, and the idea of using stem cells to treat this disorder has been actively discussed on an international level. And there are still, at this point, sufficient concerns about the likelihood that a stem cell transplant could work. Based on the reasons I gave before, we're concerned that those cells, once transplanted, could still undergo the same sort of difficulties as the oligodendrocytes in your own body. I just want to raise one other point, though, that we have been able to learn much more about the biology of the oligodendrocyte. And so a new and very hopeful avenue that really comes out of an understanding of stem cell biology is how we could perhaps better instruct the normal oligodendrocytes in MS patients to perform better in the process of reparative processes resulting in remyelination.
So sort of boosting what's already there? I mean, making kind of something work better that is already in existence?
Exactly. So as we start to understand more about how to regulate stem cells, we're starting to understand how to make the body's own stem cells perform better in the process of repair. And so that's another, I think, very important benefit of this area of research. We may come up with non-cell-based therapies that could still help to promote the body's own ability to repair itself.
Dr. Vernick, Claire mentioned in this that one of the reasons why she's interested and would love to see something done is that she's allergic to some of the drug therapies, which makes me think again about this question of part of what's valuable about the work that you're doing in terms of taking – if you could take a cell of Claire's, for example, because it's Claire, you could learn that much more about her particular condition and what might work for her. Is that right?
Exactly. So that is what we call personalized medicine, so to say. The genome, you must imagine, is – is like an ocean. We really, even though we have sequenced it, we really don't understand the majority of it. And but using this technology to take, for example, Claire's skin cells and turning them into stem cells and then study those cells, we don't have to know the exact letters in the genome which actually are causing her phenotype or her disease. But we can work with the cells. So that is why it's such a great advantage.
So, but question. Go
I also
ahead.
Wanted
yeah.
to mention there is a, there. So MS is an autoimmune disease, and so the underlying reason why these why the brain is attacked is because the immune cells, the blood cells, are attacking its own tissues. So there is also the idea out there that when you treat these. And that would be true for any kind of autoimmune disease, with blood stem cells, with new blood stem cells, that then you would hopefully erase these autoimmune attack.
Quick question here from Mike about the prospects of tracheal transplants. Do you know anything about that, Dr. Kriegstein?
Well, some of this has happened already overseas, the idea of replacing a tissue type. So we're not talking now about a single cell, but rather a kind of an organ system or a part of a system, which involves a tissue engineering as well as a stem cell implants and so on. And I think that's a sort of second-level approach of actually regenerating organs. And that involves partnerships between stem cell biology as well as people working in biomaterials. And there's a great deal of excitement about that approach for certain kinds of tissue replacement.
Just about out of time, but a quick last thought on what you're most excited about if you had to identify the prospects for this work that you're all engaged in. What's the most tantalizing to you, I guess, at this moment?
Well, I have to admit that as sitting in the perspective I have, the global areas that are impacted by stem cell biology are so vast that I think even a few years ago that would have been hard to imagine. Not only are stem cells being used as replacement tissues or delivery vehicles grafted into patients, but they're being used to understand unravel disease mechanisms, screen for drugs, screen for toxicity of conventional drug therapy, to understand the immune system, to unravel mysteries that, you know, we just never thought stem cells would allow us to do, and all of this in human disease.
Still a good deal, then, for California to pursue.
I think absolutely.
We'll have to leave it there. Dr. Arnold Kriegstein is the director of the Center of Regeneration Medicine and Stem Cell Research at UCSF. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
David Roach joined us, too, also from UCSF, where he's the chief of neonatology. Thank you, David.
Thanks, David.
And Marius Wernig, assistant professor at the Institute for Stem Cell Biology at Stanford. Thanks. Thanks as well.
You too.
And this is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.